Good morning and welcome to MTSU on the Record. I'm Jenna Logue, and we're coming to you from the campus of Middle Tennessee State University in Murfreesboro, Tennessee, in the studios of WMOT-FM. Well, did all those poll numbers reported by the media during the election confuse you? Polls confuse a lot of us, and MTSU has conducted its own poll for years, giving its mass communication students an opportunity to learn how to conduct a survey. Today we're going to talk about polls, ours and others, with Dr. Jason Reinecke, the Associate Director of the MTSU poll and an Assistant Professor of Journalism. It's Jason's first time on the show. Yay. Welcome.
Thank you, Jenna. It's a pleasure to be here.
It seems that in days of yore, when I was a child, there were only like two or three major polls, you know, Gallup, Roper, and the names sort of became ingrained in your brain. Is it my imagination, or has the number of national polls just like exploded in recent years?
Certainly there are a lot more polls in the last 10 to 12 years than there have been in the past. Many of those are funded and sponsored by news organizations that work in conjunction with polling organizations, the more traditional, familiar polling names like Gallup and Roper and Zogby. But certainly in an election year especially, we see a lot more polls published a lot more frequently.
Why have we seen more polling organizations crop up, those that are in the private sector and those associated with universities? And are they so expensive that the news organizations have to glom on to them three at a time? For example, the Wall Street Journal NBC News poll, for example. Is the cost of it so high that you have to virtually get three sponsors in order to pay for it?
It's not an exceptionally high cost enterprise, but having said that, journalism outlets are facing increasing economic pressures like many other industries, and so anything that they can do helps. The prominence of polls and the new organizations that you mentioned sprouting up all the time, it seems like, I think are largely attributable to the fact that there's a market for polling numbers and polling information. And I don't just mean that in terms of there are people who are willing to pay for the information. There's also a thirst in the public for information regarding what people are thinking regarding elected officials and upcoming elections. And there's also a big news hole that needs to be filled, if you will. There's a 24-hour-a-day news cycle on cable television on three and more than three major cable news outlets, and they need stories. And a good go-to story is always the horse race, who's ahead in today's polls. And so I think a lot of it's attributable to that sort of thirst for information that the public has and that news media outlets have.
Does the public believe what they read and what they hear when polls are reported to them? Is it the fact that it's having something quantifiable is more reliable to them than just the anecdotal information they get by talking to their neighbors and their coworkers around the water cooler?
Well, I can say from the perspective of someone who spent a lot of his time in graduate school studying polling methodology and sampling and how to write survey questions and how to analyze the data properly, that it is a pretty reliable way, the most reliable way we have of assessing the sort of mass opinions, what people in general in a particular area think. Now, what do the public think about polling numbers? Well, there's some segment of the population who's always going to agree with polls when those polls agree with what they think previously and think that the polls are not so worthwhile, we might say, when they disagree with what people think, basically. But I think generally the public overall has a sort of a cautious faith in polling, because we tend to get things right. Now, there are the odd off cases, such as the Democratic primary in New Hampshire this year, where many polling organizations all sort of got things wrong. But for the most part, if you look across polls, most of the time, we get things pretty much right, whether that means that there's going to be a big victory one way or the other, or that things are going to be kind of too close to call. And people see that and they remember that. And so I think the general public has a sort of cautious optimism with regard to the validity of polls, and I think rightfully so.
How do these various polls differ in methodology? I can only assume that it's become such a growth industry because each company pitches itself to whatever prospective sponsor on the basis of its belief that it has something different and better to offer, just like any other business.
Sure. Part of it's sort of a bang for your buck cost effectiveness issue. For example, the big academic polls and surveys that are conducted once every couple of years. There's a survey called the General Social Survey, for example, that's conducted out of the University of Chicago every 2 years. And that uses a technique that we call cluster sampling, which picks blocks at random, so city and town blocks, and blocks even out in rural areas, and then selects those at random from the nation as a whole, and then sends pollsters on foot, if you will, to knock on doors and talk to people at each one of those residences that happen to be on one of those randomly selected blocks. That's sort of the most intensive, most expensive way to do a poll. Most polls that you see, especially published in the media, use what we call random digit dialing, which uses telephone numbers selected at random in order to get a random sample of the population, or rather, to be more specific, the population that has telephones. And so that technique allows us to sample the population in a way that's a little bit less expensive than going around and sending people around and knocking on doors. After that, you've got automated calls, which would also use random digit dialing, but rather than a live interviewer asking the questions, would use a pre-recorded survey that asks the questions, and then you can indicate your responses either through voice recognition software or by punching a number on your touch-tone phone.
I've gotten robocalls before, but never a robo-survey.
Yeah, and that's an important distinction to make. Robo-surveys, if you will, or we don't like to use that robo term with our stuff, but,
sorry
but
about that.
Automated surveys are a little bit different than robocalls, which are just pre-recorded pitches, whereas an automated survey would ask questions and ask you to indicate your responses. And then finally, the sort of new frontier, if you will, although it's not that new anymore, is internet surveys. And those are a little bit less generalizable to the population as a whole because there are still fewer people who use the internet and who are comfortable using the internet than have telephones. But again, a little bit more cost effective than dialing a bunch of phone numbers and paying the bill on that. So those are sort of the three main methods, the face-to-face interview, the random digit dialing, and internet surveys that are being used today. And a lot of what goes into selecting which is going to be best for the job at hand involves cost effectiveness and the population that you want to reach and how generalizable you want your results to be, and also how many questions you have to ask. If you're going to ask someone 100, 150 questions, as we do sometimes in the big academic surveys, it's beneficial to go around and knock on people's doors and sit down in their living room and ask them those questions for a little while. Whereas if you're going to only take 20 minutes or a half hour, it's easier to do that over the phone.
And so, let these people know in advance when you go into their homes, before you go into their homes, that it's going to take X amount of time
absolutely.
Out of their day, because if you just show up and ask 150 questions, that they're going to go, when is this thing over?
Sure. And that's part of our ethics as pollsters, is to try and treat our respondents well, because obviously we're out of work if people decide not to participate, not to answer our questions. And your listeners can find out more about polling ethics at the website of the American Association for Public Opinion Research. That's www.aport.org. And that's a nonpartisan organization that oversees polling. It's a professional body for pollsters like me.
Do people who use random calling as a technique, can the people on the other end ever be subject to hoaxes? For example, do people pretend to be pollsters just to call up and try to get information about somebody else? And how do you know whether the person on the other end of the phone line represents a legitimate organization?
Sure. That does unfortunately happen sometimes, that various groups or individual campaigns, for example, may pose as pollsters and do what we call push polling, which is not really legitimate polling at all. And I'll again refer your listeners to that website, APOR.org. They have a really nice description of the distinction between legitimate polling and push polling. So when very loaded and biased questions are used, sometimes the intent is to influence public opinion more than it is to assess or measure public opinion. And what good pollsters do, what ethical pollsters do, I should say, is attempt to assess public opinion rather than influence it. And so that's our goal as pollsters here at the MTSU poll, is to provide a non-biased, non-partisan measurement of opinion in the state of Tennessee. And anyone interested in hiring pollsters to do public opinion research, for example, on a private company's products, I would highly recommend that they look for someone who's going to go into the process in a non-biased manner and give valid and reliable results, rather than perhaps the results that the sponsor wants to hear. And so one of the ways to know a legitimate poll from a push poll, or recognize the organization should make its identity known immediately at the beginning of the call. I am from this organization. I'd like to ask you a few questions about these issues, and should go forth in a manner that doesn't give the respondent the impression that they're trying to be influenced rather than trying to be measured. We do our best to ask non-biased questions. We're not perfect, and obviously we all come at things from our own perspectives, but the goal is to do the best that we can to ask non-leading questions. And when questions sometimes are clearly leading, that's a good indicator that you may be the victim, if you will, of a push poll.
The you really have to parse the words, don't you? Take a hot button issue like abortion, for example.
Sure.
Even the terms pro-choice and pro-life carry with them a certain kind of loaded influence, if you will. People who are pro-choice would rather refer to people who say they are pro-life, for example, as anti-abortion, because mm-hmm. to refer to them as pro-life implies that people who are pro-choice are somehow anti-life. So how do you parse the language so that you get the least biased question possible?
Sure. A lot of what we rely on is precedent. So we look at how other people have asked these questions in the past, and we look at the results of those questions. And if, for example, someone made a change to how the questions are typically asked with regard to abortion, for example, we would look at those results. And if there's a change to how the questions asked and a change in the results that we see in terms of the number of people who, for example, classify themselves as pro-life or pro-choice or pro-abortion or anti-abortion, depending on how those categories are lined up for people to respond to, we would then look at the precedent established by how the question is typically asked and the comparison of how the changes were made. And if we see a big change in the results, we'll recognize that probably there's something going on there that we need to pay attention to with regard to question wording. And we are very careful to try and ask balanced questions, and to ask questions that only ask about one thing at a time. So, for example, in the sort of political rhetoric a few years ago, it was popular to say, well, do you support President Bush and the troops in the Middle East? And that would be perhaps effective as political rhetoric one way or the other, but it would be a very bad survey question, because we'd be asking about two things at once. And so if a person, for example, supported the president but not the troops, so to speak, or more likely the troops but not the president, how would that person answer in a yes or no manner? It would be very difficult to do so. And so we try and ask only questions that ask about one thing at a time, and we try to use standard question wording that the public is generally pretty familiar with. And we keep a close eye on our results in comparison to previous results to see if there are any question wording effects that we see.
A lot of times during political campaigns, we hear about piggyback polls. What are piggyback polls?
I'm not familiar
with
that term,
with the term,
actually.
I had heard it was where you're supposed to ask about one particular candidate, and then at the end they just sort of throw on, well, let me ask you about Joe Blow, who's a good friend of so-and-so. How would you feel if he ran for Senate?
Have you
ever heard of an organization doing that?
No, not offhand. There was some concern about I know I was at a public opinion conference recently, and there was some concern about some polling that was done during the presidential election that the results were only made public for one candidate, but not the other presidential candidate. And essentially, the results said that the people who supported this particular candidate didn't appear to be especially informed, didn't appear to answer general political knowledge questions correctly on the whole. But the results regarding the other candidate's supporters either weren't assessed or weren't published. And that was an ethical issue with regard to the current the immediately previous election. With regard to the sort of piggyback poll idea that you're referring to, it sounds like something that would be fairly common for partisan polling. The Democratic and Republican parties obviously do polling of their own, and they want to know about the issues and candidates that are most relevant to them. So it wouldn't be inherently unethical to ask only about the Republican presidential candidate and the Republican candidate for Congress here in Tennessee or in a particular district in Tennessee.
So floating some guy's name out there as a trial balloon or a hypothetical on a poll that is mainly about a real candidate in the real world is not necessarily an unethical thing, in terms of just as a concept, or would it depend upon how you did it?
I see what you're getting at. I think, no, it wouldn't be unethical in principle, but it would be important to be clear about who this person is and whether or not they're actually a candidate running for office or someone who may run for office, so that the pollster doesn't end up misleading people with regard to who the candidates are, who's running, and who's not. So the key point with regard to an issue like this would be to make sure to inform the respondents about the nature of the issue at hand and who this person running is or not running is, or whether you were asking about, for example, well, there are many people who may run for Senate in Tennessee the next time around. Here are some names of people who may or may not run for Senate. Do you think they'd be a good choice or not? Rather than just saying, well, do you think this person would be a good senator or a poor senator?
How do you know when you're trying to get a sample? How do you know when you've got a representative sample? How big a sample is a big enough sample?
Sure. Well, there's fairly complicated statistical backup for how we determine what the number of people in a particular area is. It's a lot of science and a little bit of art. We also use a technique called weighting, where we look at census data for a particular area that we want to generalize to the population. And then we look at the makeup of our sample. And if, for example, we have underrepresented, people like me, for example, white males 18 to 30 years old underrepresented, as we often do have males 18 to 30 years old underrepresented in our samples because they tend not to want to talk to pollsters for whatever reason. We would then go to the census data and we would weight the responses of the people in that particular demographic higher or lower relative to the rest of the sample in order to make the proportion of responses in our results match the proportion of that particular demographic in the population. And so we do a little bit of that. We don't like to do a lot of it because sometimes the census numbers aren't current anymore.
It's been very controversial in when it has been used by Nielsen and Arbitron in trying to determine TV and radio ratings.
Uh-huh. And so we're very careful with that. Generally, it tends to work and tends to give us better results in terms of predicting elections and those sorts of outcomes. But we have to be very careful with it, obviously, because sometimes those numbers are no longer accurate because a census is only conducted about every 10 years, as you know. So we use those sorts of techniques, and our random sampling does a really good job of getting at the people who are accessible through a particular means of conducting a poll. So again, if we go door to door, we're not going to reach homeless people. We're not going to reach people who basically travel all around the world and live in hotels, or travel all around the country as salespeople and live in hotels and motels. If we use random digit dialing of only landline phones, obviously we don't reach people who only use cell phones. And that's a big issue in polling right now, is figuring out the best way to conduct random digit dialing samples and reach both people who only use landline and only use mobile phones. And so obviously in those cases, we're potentially cutting a group of people out. If we use internet surveys, obviously we're only going to reach people who have access to the internet. And so we have to look at our methods and the limitations of our methods with any single particular poll and take that into consideration when determining how representative our sample is. And, you know, I always encourage something I encourage my undergraduate students in the classes that I teach in general, and something that I try to do myself in my own life, is to look at things in the world with a critical eye, and to look at polls with a critical eye, but to look at them with a constructively critical eye rather than a dismissively or destructively critical eye.
Or and cynical.
Sure. And so all of your listeners should pay close attention and be aware of the shortcomings of any particular poll, but also understand that if you look across the methods and across the many polls, in general, we tend to get things right the vast majority of the time. And that, I think, is the proof in the pudding, so to speak, that really lends itself to the idea that, yeah, generally overall, we get things right, and these results are pretty representative of the populations that we try to measure.
So when you decide what kind of questions to ask in the MT poll, for example, it's not as though you and Dr. Wyatt and Dr. Blake get together with a six-pack and a USA Today and just sit around and go, hey, what do you think about this one, you know?
No, certainly not. We ask a variety of questions. We look at the poll as very much a form of public service to the state of Tennessee. So we always ask the sort of standard polling questions. We ask about presidential approval. We ask about gubernatorial approval. We ask about congressional and state house approval. And then we usually try and ask about each poll one or two substantive issues in the state of Tennessee. So in the past, we've asked about things like immigration. We ask about people's religious beliefs in order to assess the religious makeup of the state. We ask about things like the economy in the state. And so we try and do those basic general standard polling questions and make sure that the voice of Tennesseans are heard in the state of Tennessee and nationally as well with regard to those issues. And then also usually each poll one or two sort of substantive issues. We also see part of our public service is doing strong academic research. So usually some of the poll is dedicated to theoretical issues in research regarding public opinion that ends up published in academic journals and presented at conferences around the country. And so we see that as a good way to represent Middle Tennessee State University as well.
And in the MT poll, you also get the demographic data, right? Male,
absolutely.
Female, age range, income range, where do you live, that kind
education,
of thing.
Education, yeah. We always get those variables as well. And those are important explanatory variables in a very general sense at understanding particular groups of people who answer particular questions particular ways.
What kind of guidance do you give the students who work on the MT poll, knowing, of course, that they don't have the background in study that you do, and this might be the first time they've ever done anything like this?
Sure. Well, they're all communication students, and so they do have some rudimentary training in mass media and communicating with people and how to present themselves well and speak well. So that's a great base to start with, first of all. They do go through about an hour-long training process at the beginning of the night that they work on the poll, and that teaches them how to use the computer system that they use and coaches them up on how to work as pollsters, if you will, for a day. And so we go through that process. We have a great staff of people who oversee data collection and make sure that any problems that our surveyors run into are addressed quickly and effectively. And so we tend to, again, get very good results, both in terms of being able to predict and understand opinion in the state of Tennessee and in interviewee satisfaction. The respondents to our poll usually finish the poll in a very good mood, and that's a great benefit for us.
With as many organizations as there are out there and as many universities as there are doing polls as well, is this a quote-unquote growth industry that one should consider as a career? I think of it as kind of a left-brain, right-brain thing. I think of the statisticians maybe not making the best interviewers, and the people persons being the good interviewers but not necessarily being great in the math department.
Sure. It is very much, and I think I mentioned this before, but it is very much both an art and a science. There's a lot of statistical heavy lifting that goes into any poll in terms of designing the sample and determining how many people you need to survey, what the response rate is, so the number of people that complete interviews for the number of phone calls that we make, for example, and then analyzing the results often involves fairly rigorous statistical analysis as well. But also, it is very much of an art, as you allude to, in designing these questions and asking people questions that make sense to them. Because, you know, we as pollsters kind of sit around and work on this stuff really hard and think about it all day long, but that doesn't always lead us to have the same perspective in terms of how these issues are framed or thought about or the specific words that are used in the general public. So we have to sort of put ourselves in the average Joe or average Jane's shoes when thinking about how we're going to ask these questions as well. And so, is it a growth industry? Well, it seems to be. I mean, it seems to be over the last 8 to 10 years, there's just more and more demand and more interest for polling information. To be a good pollster does mean typically going to graduate school or going out very early and doing a lot of internships and getting your hands dirty with interviewing and doing the sort of basic entry-level work. But I love doing public opinion polling, and I would recommend that anyone interested in it look into it and study up on it and take classes and learn more.
Can you make a good living?
Yeah, you can make a very good living, and it depends on how you define a good living as well. And you can make a lot of different types of good livings doing public opinion polling. I, for example, really enjoy being an academic. I love teaching. I love doing research. I love sort of the university environment and community and collegiality that you get in this environment. And so, you know, those are the most important things to me in my life right now. And as a pollster, I'm able to do that. After 5 years of graduate school, I'm able to become a professor and come to a university and do public opinion polling and teach and do research. And it's wonderful. On the private side, in the private sector, the sort of consulting opportunities are very good, and people can make a very, very good wage if they understand public opinion with regard to a particular issue or more specifically, a particular product, whether that product, if you will, be a political candidate or a political issue or what we might think of as a more traditional product, widgets or soda or anything else. And so there are a lot of opportunities to make a lot of different types of very good livings as a pollster.
Of course, after you've already conducted the poll and you've released it to the news media, it's out of your hands. You're not responsible for how a bunch of pundits sit around on a television set and chew it over for 5 hours and digest it to a fare-thee-well. But how do you think, what is your general opinion of the way the media use polling or report polling? Do they get it? Do they misconstrue your work? What, do they understand what they're communicating to the public?
Sure, that's a really good question. The one thing I would say is that we do, when we are release our results, we do encourage media outlets to contact us directly, and we're always happy to talk about our poll results in settings like this and immediately a following release to discuss where those numbers came from and where we think they're going and what they represent. So we're always happy to be a first contact, and we recommend that as well because obviously we're the people most familiar with our data. I think the analysis of polls in the news media is generally decent but very basic. What the public gets usually is a breakdown of 49% to 51% yay and nay, or this candidate and that candidate. And that's nice, but it doesn't really tell people from whence those opinions came. And that's what we're most interested in as researchers, is what drives the formation of people's opinions. Now, sometimes you'll get a breakdown among men and women, for example, or whites and African Americans and people of other racial and ethnic backgrounds. And that's okay, too. But what we're really interested in are things like, you know, do people who have more education think about a particular issue differently than people who have relatively less education?
Sociological and psychological angles.
Absolutely. And, you know, do people who talk about politics more think about an issue one way versus people who talk about politics less thinking about it a different way? And do people who watch the news more or less have differences in how they think about particular issues and their outcomes of opinion outcomes with regard to those issues. Other things, like not just, do you support candidate X or candidate Y, but for what reasons do you support candidate X or candidate Y? And those sort of reasons and thought processes that go into things are very informative, as well as just that sort of score breakdown that you see at the end of the day. Well, this person or this side of the issue is winning today, that horse race coverage, which is useful, I think, to the public, but is fairly rough and just scratches the surface or the tip of the iceberg, if you will, of what's really going on and happening with public opinion. So I understand the news media's need to present things in an easily digestible format that is easy for people to understand. At the same time, I would love to see and think it would be really nice if we could also talk more in depth when a poll's released about, what we see as the reasons for why people take a particular side in a particular issue, because that, I think, can be very informative and useful to the public as well.
When can we expect the new MTSU spring poll to come out? Ballpark figure.
Ballpark figure, February or March. We're right now in the process of finishing this semester up. But once we're done with our finals and everything, we've got some meetings scheduled to sit down and start our planning process for exactly what questions we're going to ask and do all of our computer programming that allows our telephone interviewing system to work. And we'll probably look for a data collection sometime in February or March, and then we release our results immediately after we're finished. So that's the sort of time frame that we're looking at or planning for right now, knock on wood.
If you want to know more about the MTSU poll, go to www.mtsusurveygroup.org. That's mtsusurveygroup.org. That's a lot easier to remember on the radio than a bunch of telephone numbers. It's okay. Dr. Jason Reinicke, thank you for being with us.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure.
This is MTSU on the Record. I'm Jenna Logue. Please join us again at the same time next Sunday. You can catch the podcast at mtsunews.com. And remember, we're also available on iTunes.